For the first time in human history, what we do or do not do over the next 5 to 10 years will not only impact future generations, but really planetary future generations.
That's futurist Ari Wallach, explaining how the decisions innovators make today will reverberate for generations to come. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast. On his new PBS series, A Brief History of the Future, Ari Wallach explores how humans of today can become better ancestors to generations of tomorrow.
3D printing is a leading contender in in-space construction.
Fusion is really the holy grail of energy.
The sustainable city is not only better for the environment, it's much more enjoyable for the people that live in it.
Wallach has served as a strategic innovation consultant for corporations, media outlets, and government agencies. He is also the founder of LongPath Labs, which is an initiative dedicated to shifting humanity's focus from short-term to long-term thinking.
I'm trying to get folks to think about the future not as a thing that we hurtle towards, not a wave that's going to crash over us, but a thing that we make consciously through the decisions that we make.
With this 6-part documentary series, Wallach examines the unfolding impact of new technologies and new ideas.
How we decide to build our AI machines, our immortal engines of creativity, will decide and dictate how we run our societies and civilizations for decades, if not centuries.
And he attempts to offer an antidote to dystopia and doomerism.
So my goal and hope for the show is that people will have a renewed sense of agency, of hope, and of awe for what tomorrow could bring.
Ari Wallach, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me.
You're an author, a futurist, the founder of LongPath Labs, which is an initiative that focuses on the future of humanity. What is a futurist?
So there's kind of a common misconception, which is a futurist is someone who predicts tomorrow, what's going to happen. Look, people have been futuring for centuries, right? In some ways, trying to think about tomorrow. But a professional working futurist like myself, we don't predict the future. What we do is we study megatrends. We're almost like anthropologists from tomorrow looking backwards. So a megatrend is something like demographics, obviously population or climate change, things that have been happening for decades and that will unfurl for decades. And then we look to see how those megatrends, and at LongPath, we track 21 megatrends, how those will impact us in the years to come. And then from that, we start to develop stories, scenarios of what could happen. And from that, we help people, organizations, countries, governments make better decisions about tomorrow.
What's an example of a megatrend?
So one of them is obviously, you know, boomers in America, and we look at kind of aging populations. But we'll look at something very specific like climate-based migration. So right now we know there are tens of millions of people on the move for various reasons. But as we look forward, we're seeing hundreds of millions of people over the coming decades who will be moving specifically because of climate-based reasons. So that's a megatrend we look at.
How did this become your life's calling?
Everyone comes into futuring differently. I came into it through the dinner table, right? So my father was born in the 1920s in Poland in Europe. And obviously at an early age, there was World War II. And he ended up escaping from a ghetto and he joined the Jewish underground. So growing up, I would hear these stories about, you know, life in the forest. And not only was it life in the forest, but it was kind of him on the run, but always kind of thinking about how we got to that point. So it wasn't just about World War II, but it was about the 1920s and the 1930s. On the flip side, my mom was a student of Buckminster Fuller, who was probably one of the greatest futurists of the last century. So every dinner table conversation, whatever it is that we were talking about, existed over almost a 200-year span of time. My dad talking about, well, how did we get here? And my mom saying, well, where are we going to go from here? And then over the years, it became apparent that this was going to be my life's calling, trying to help us both avoid the worst of humanity and at the same time, try to figure out how we can call to the best of humanity. And that's the kind of way that I became a futurist.
You use the verb futuring. Why do you make it a verb?
So more often than not, we think of the future as a noun, as this thing that's out there that we're kind of heading towards, almost like a pronoun, if you will. I think of the future very much as a verb. It's something that we do. It's something that we're doing right now. It's how you say goodbye to your children in the morning. And it's also where you invest your billions of dollars if you're the head of a government. It's something that we constantly make. And that's in many ways why I'm doing this work at Long Path and at Brief History of the Future. I'm trying to get folks to think about the future, not as a thing that we hurtle towards, not a wave that's going to crash over us, but a thing that we make consciously through the decisions that we make.
You also use the term lung pathing, right?
Yeah.
It's almost as though by making it an active verb, you're connecting our lives as they currently are to the future,
yeah,
rather than as an abstraction.
Yeah. So the reason I use the term long path is because, yes, I want to make it where we are right now and how that connects to the future, but it's also about connecting to the past, right? You and I are here because of the decisions that were made by our ancestors. And so for me, the most important question we can be asking ourselves as individuals, as citizens, as members of society, heck, as Homo sapiens, is how do we become the great ancestors our future needs, right? More often than not, we make decisions through what I call are the lens of our lifespan. We have a lifespan bias. I'm thinking about what's best for Ari from my birth to my death. That makes sense. In Long Path, I'm asking people to kind of step back and step up and think, well, how did I get here and where are we going? So you no longer see yourself just within this self-contained unit of your own lifespan, which you need to do day in and day out, but to actually think about how am I connected to something bigger that came before me? And how am I connecting to something bigger that's going to come long after I'm gone?
You're the host of a new PBS series, A Brief History of the Future, which has debuted this week. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Which explores all the topics that you've just described. How can we become great ancestors for future generations? And you describe in the series how we're at an intertidal moment.
Yes.
What is that?
So if, you know, in the marine biology sense, an intertidal is that place that many of us have been to if we've been to the ocean's edge. And it's that piece of land that sometimes is below water and sometimes is, you know, above water. It's just that's called the intertidal zone. But as a species, as a global planetary civilization, it's my belief that we are in that in-between zone, right? We are kind of coming at a point where we're at the tail end of enlightenment, rational, logos-based thinking. And a lot of the institutions that were built over the past couple hundred years that have served us really well are no longer serving us as well. At the same time, we're not exactly sure what's coming next. So the old world is kind of dying. The new one is yet to be born. That's an intertidal. The intertidal, obviously, if you've been to the ocean edge, is a place of chaos. It's also a place of mass creativity. And so that's the point we find ourselves in terms of technology, demographics, climate change, synthetic biology, world powers colliding. We're in that in-between place.
Give me some examples of what about the old world is failing us now.
So, I mean, look, we'll take a very classic example of voting here in America. Well, you know, why do we vote on Tuesdays, right? We vote on Tuesdays. It's very important as a citizen to, you know, to go on Tuesdays every 2 years, but every 4 years we go and vote on Tuesday. One of the reasons, actually the main reason we vote on Tuesday is it took about 2 days for a land-owning male to go from church on a Sunday to ride to the nearest town to vote on a Tuesday. So here we are, probably the most powerful country that has ever existed on planet Earth. And our entire idea of how we vote and when we vote is based on how long it took us to get to the big town from horseback. So our institutions, how we, let's take education. You know, I have three children. Every hour a bell rings and they move to a different subject. Why? Because education, as we moved from 97% of Americans being based in agriculture 120 years ago to deep urbanization, our entire education system was predicated on the assembly line, much how we built the Model T. And if you've ever looked at an assembly line, every few minutes a bell rings and they move the car down the assembly line. That's how we've actually built education as a system. So from education to citizenship and voting to even how we run our legislators, those are all based on kind of older ways of doing and thinking that don't make sense so much in this day and age.
In the series, you say humanity is at a crossroads. How do you describe that crossroads?
Look, this crossroads moment we're in, this inflection point, is one that's very different because we have seen civilizations, empires rise and fall, but it's always been kind of localized. It might be Machu Picchu, it might be the Mayan, it may be dynasties in China. But for the first time in human history, what we do or do not do over the next 5 to 10 years will not only impact future generations, but really planetary future generations. Let's take artificial intelligence as an example. The coding that we're doing right now in AI, in many ways, is immortal, right? So how we decide to build our AI machines, our immortal engines of creativity, will decide and dictate how we run our societies and civilizations for decades, if not centuries. We can say the same thing about climate change. We can say the same thing about genetic engineering, right? Synthetic biology went from, you know, how do we kind of work with DNA at the individual level to now we're doing germline engineering. So it's no longer about kind of fixing me and my disease right now, but that actually gets passed on and can go on for centuries.
How should we think about the implications of those decisions?
Yeah, I mean, so right now, when we make decisions, it only affects me or me in my own life or me in my own lifespan. When we're sitting down and we're thinking, how are we going to build this large, you know, language model, this AI system, or how are we going to genetically manipulate this cancer patient who may go on to have kids? It's no longer just about them. It's about the generations to come, right? So stepping back, I said, I have 3 children. If things kind of go the way they tend to go, in 200-300 years, there's going to be anywhere from 10 to 12,000 descendants just based off of me, my wife, and our 3 kids.
Yeah.
Those are long-term ramifications just in the decisions that we do in our home. Now, imagine that writ large in terms of climate change, artificial intelligence, genetics. Hey, even how we talk to our kids, right? So much of how I parent is based off of what was modeled to me by my parents, who are amazing. But now I'm passing that on to my kids. So sometimes it's this big highfalutin thing like genetics and artificial intelligence. Sometimes it's actually hyperlocal.
But to your point about these new technologies and this crossroads in terms of how the next 5 to 10 years can actually change the future and future generations in the long path, a lot of people are worried about the implications of these new technologies. And I don't mean negativity bias. I'll get to that next. How should we be thinking then about these new technologies and their possible negative implications?
Well, we should be thinking about new technologies, both in terms of their negative implications and their positive implications. And so what's really missing, and we get at this in the show, is we actually don't have a telos or an ultimate goal of what we want to get to. In some ways, we're like a ship trying to navigate without any idea of what our destination is.
We as humanity.
We as humanity. When I say we, I mean Homo sapiens. I mean that kind of branch that was very fortunate that kept going off of, you know, primates to allow us to sit here today. The implications of these decisions that are right here in front of us, that are being decided within a few miles of where we're sitting, or in Silicon Valley, or down in Washington, D.C., or in Brussels, these are no longer temporally isolated just to this moment, right? We tend to cover politics and policy almost like a horse race. Like, well, who's up or down? Mm-hmm. Which is fine and understandable. But really, for the first time, if we want to think about these technologies, we need to think about them in the same way that one thinks about the most important decisions that will impact them as a family. But now we have to extend out what that family means. And what I mean by that is we have to extend that out thousands of years. These are not things that are going to go away. It's not about buying something right now, consuming it and throwing it away. What we are doing or not doing, how we are thinking about how we use artificial intelligence, how we use technology, how we talk to one another, those have long-term ramifications. So what we're asking people to do, what I'm asking people to do is step back and say, okay, I understand in the short term, what this technology might do is it might improve the bottom line in the short term, give me better quarterly earnings. That's understandable. But what we really have to ask ourselves and our leaders to do is step back and say, now, how is this going to impact future generations? And you start making very different decisions when you see your decisions no longer just about impacting you or your lifespan or your kind of shorter temporal horizon, but impacting the future of humanity.
You talk about how humans have a negativity bias. that inherently we are always thinking about what's around the corner from a fearful perspective, rather than considering what could go right or what could go well. At this crossroads, how do you think about that negativity bias, and does it hinder our ability to perceive the long path?
Yeah, I mean, look, the negativity bias served us well. So if Margaret and Ari were walking around 20,000 years ago on the Serengeti or, you know, the plains, what we were scanning for were bad things, because bad things could hurt us and they could kill us. And if we're striving for life, we're going to be looking for the negative. We're not going to be looking for flourishing. Yes, we want to see that tree that has a bunch of fruit on it. We're looking for that, but we're really kind of constantly scanning for the bad. That is built into our underlying Homo sapien hardware. That's our negativity bias. It doesn't mean we're always looking for a dumpster fire. It just means we're attracted to it, because that usually means it's something that's going to harm or kill us and lead to the cessation of our life. That being said, in an intertidal moment, we have to ask ourselves to both recognize that that negativity bias is there, but then look for something different. And what that different is a sense and an idea of what it means to flourish, what it means to get things right. It's not that we don't know how to do it. It doesn't come to us right away. So what's so important in this very moment is when we're reading the headline, you know, watching the news, going about our daily life, sure, look and learn from the negative things. But at the same time, figure out what is it that we actually want. And I'll give you a smaller example of this. Whenever I talk to friends of mine who are single, and I'll say, well, you know, what are you looking for in a relationship? They'll immediately list off five things they're not looking for. They'll immediately give me the negative. Well, I don't want him to be like this. I don't want her to be like this. I said, no. I'm asking you, what is it that you want? And it's so difficult for us to actually come forward and say that, because we're so used to being negative. Because in some ways, that's how we're wired, but it's not the only way.
When you look at some of the major challenges facing us in the moment, climate change, AI, there are those who worry that we're already past the point of no return. What do you say to those people?
Look, I grew up in the climate movement, the environmental movement. And so for a long time, the images that resonated with me was a polar bear on a small piece of ice. And I was like, oh, that's it. Everything's over. You know, I'm going to prep for the coming apocalypse. The fact of the matter is, and we do this over six episodes in this show, is we are finding people who are building better tomorrows. Sure, things are not in the ideal state on this planet across a number of indices. At the same time, if I was to be born any time in the Homo sapien arc of history to this point, I'd want to be born right now anywhere on the planet. Doesn't mean it's going to be amazing. Look, I worked with the UN Refugee Agency for a while, so I've seen how bad it can get. But the fact of the matter is, there are more people trying to do well by this current moment than there are people fighting against it. The headlines will say, oh, these people are against democracy, you know, fossil fuel industry. Those things are all actually very true. But what you'll see over 6 hours, 72 different interviews, are people who are saying, yes, I get that, but here's how we can use technology. Here's how we can use new ways of thinking about spirituality and psychology and education and democracy and governance and citizen participation to get us to better tomorrows, as opposed to just accepting the doom and gloom narratives that are foisted upon us day in and day out.
One of the images and metaphors that the series begins with is Cordoba, Spain, and the building of a mosque over many centuries that became a cathedral, continuing to be built on top of that mosque over many centuries. Talk about that metaphor and how that applies to how we should think about the future now.
So we call it cathedral thinking, which is biased towards a certain way of thinking about it. We can call it mosque thinking or synagogue thinking, if you will. But really, cathedrals started in the Middle Ages, often took 100, 150, 200 years to build. So the people who were literally building these cathedrals and designing them and laying the cornerstone knew from the get-go they would not be around to see them finished. We no longer have that way of thinking, right? If we look at we can keep the metaphor within the physical space. We see the homes that go up or the furniture that we, you know, we buy at certain stores that last 6 months, let alone multi-generational. The core argument of the show is, how do we move to cathedral thinking in everything that we do? How do we build for tomorrow in a way that recognizes that we may not be here to see that fully executed, but we're okay with that because we know we're actually building something better that will last beyond us.
Where are we building cathedrals today?
Well, it's interesting. Where we're mostly building cathedrals today without thinking about it is artificial intelligence and how we build our energy infrastructure. We're doing the opposite of cathedral thinking, right? We're doing kind of short path.
You just answered the question with a negative.
Well, I always start with the negative because it's what people are thinking. And then I switch to the positive. So the where we're doing it right now, so we visit a fusion laboratory in Livermore. And what the scientist said to me is, look, the work that she's doing right now is based on the work of a scientist who's no longer with us, and she's continuing it. So I think in massive infrastructure projects around energy, specifically, we're building those cathedrals. But it's very difficult, more and more, to find cathedral thinking manifesting today.
Is Elon Musk building cathedrals with his rockets and his exploration, his intention to get to Mars? Is that an example of cathedral thinking?
Look, whether or not someone agrees with everything that he's doing, the fact of the matter is—
I don't just mean that example. I'm not asking you to opine on Elon Musk broadly. I just mean, is that an example of cathedral thinking?
Yeah, an example—
Getting humans to Mars.
Getting humans to Mars, thinking about how we live over the coming centuries is cathedral thinking. So whether you agree with it or not, building rockets that will eventually get us to Mars is a great example of cathedral thinking.
Elon Musk wants to go to Mars as a contingency plan for Earth, right? Yeah. There are Bill Gates, Sam Altman, individuals who are, not because of a negativity bias, I don't think, but frankly, concerned that we will self-destruct here. What is your response to that thinking?
Look, I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think it's great that people are building alternative plan Bs, but the fact of the matter is we can get things right here, and we can actually get them right here first. So I'm all for us going to Mars, but I think to myself, what are we exporting to Mars? How do we export the best version of humanity to Mars? So if we were to take a thousand people today and send them to Mars, that'd be cool. But I'd like to think that as a society, we can spend as much money on moral progress as we do on software and hardware progress. And we can do this at the same time.
You set out to find people building a better future, but not utopias. Mm-hmm. You use this term protopias. What is a protopia?
So Kevin Kelly, one of the founders of Wired Magazine, and kind of one of the greats of Silicon Valley, came up with this term many years ago called protopia. So we know dystopia, it's a place we don't want to be. It's where everything falls apart. Utopia is actually a dystopian disguise. Every utopian story eventually collapses in on itself. Protopia is an idea of tomorrow where we're making progress, but not everything is perfect. So we talk about protopian thinking throughout the show because we want people to recognize that we're not saying the future is going to be perfect. Look at all these examples. This is how everything is, this, you know, idyllic Garden of Eden. What we're saying is day in and day out, if we make things 1% better every day, every year, every decade, and we know compounding interest, that actually adds up. That's protopian thinking. Where we are today versus where we were 50 years ago is a sense of protopia. And part of what we do in the show is we visit people who are building kind of microcosms of protopia. We like to say protopia is already here, it's just unevenly distributed, right? So there are elements of projects that are happening right now that we visit around the world that are new ways of thinking and doing across a whole spectrum of activities that are better than we have today, but not perfect. That's protopia.
Who are some of your favorites?
You know, I grew up on Star Trek, so I'm predisposed to saying like a lot of the science things that we visit. I love visiting, going to Austin and seeing Melody Yashar and what they're doing and building 3D homes. But one of my favorites was just outside of Amsterdam. We visited this community called Hoogeveen, which is called basically a dementia village. Mm-hmm. And what they've done at Hoogeveen is they've decided that for the elders of their community who are going through memory care issues and early onset dementia and other neurodegenerative diseases, instead of putting them in kind of locked hospital wards, how we do it here in the US, what they realized is they could actually build almost a safe and secure village that has a grocery store, a restaurant, a cabaret, and these people could live in communities together. And what they found is there was a 80% reduction in the need for anti-anxiety or anti-depression drugs. People were just happier. So going to Hoosjavik gave me a glimpse of a future where we center humanity, where we center those who are the most vulnerable, right? So I love the technology. I love the things that we visited around the world, but it was seeing how we can think differently that changed my conception of what is possible.
And that's one that actually directly impacts sort of the human touch or the human experience.
Yeah.
I mean, all of it really impacts the human experience if you're talking about a nuclear power, a power plant that you can ski on or sort of a cleaner environment. But climate comes up a lot. It also is one that has a lot of some of the most innovative thinking, to my mind. In 1997, William F. Buckley Jr., the original host of Firing Line, hosted a debate about whether environmentalism had gone too far. Listen to this back and forth between Governor Jerry Brown of California and Jerry Jasinowski, who is the head of the National Association of Manufacturers.
170 nations in Rio in 1992 all agreed that the emission of greenhouse gases should be reduced to 1990 levels. That's not happening. Neither Clinton nor the Republican Congress gives a damn and are continuing this incredible creation of alteration in the natural environment. And we are a part of life itself. When we destroy part of that web, we are jeopardizing it.
I would just say that the kind of things that the companies I represent do and private capitalism in the world is a big part of the answer if we use it sensibly. Don't you agree that there ought to be a partnership between those of us who are interested in growth and jobs and the environmental progress?
Don't you suppose there ought to be a partnership between those who are interested in the growth of jobs and environmental progress? That was the tension in 1997, right? It was either or.
Yep.
How has that question evolved in the last 30 years? And what do you see as examples in your series to how that question has been answered?
Look, this kind of false binary.
Yeah.
Is something that we deal with all the time, both in politics and in media. And a lot of what we're trying to do in this series is move past that. And so I visit Evan Baer at Ecovative, which is a company just up north here from New York City. They're working with mycelium and with mushrooms. And what they're literally doing is they're using mycelium, which is kind of the bedrock of mushrooms, yes, to create packaging, but now also leather and furniture and eventually building materials, right?
And bacon.
And bacon. In the episode, I tried the bacon and it was tough.
You know, you said it tastes like bacon, did it really?
Well, yeah. But what you don't actually see on the show in the final cut that makes it to air is I go, with all excuses to my rabbi, this tastes just like bacon. And look, so what he's showing is that there is room for jobs and growth. And by the way, growth doesn't just mean more. Growth, you know, we grow as individuals morally, philosophically. And so it is important for people to understand that there is going to be a role for them in this kind of transition intertidal economy. So we also visit a former cod fisherman just outside of New Haven, Bren Smith. And one of the things Bren is doing is he's a kelp farmer. And he says something so insightful. And he says, this is how you get the politics right. It's no longer about either or. It's about how do we feed people's soul who might have been working in a coal mine or working in kind of old pre-intertidal industries, find a way to connect with what's most important to them, which is feed their family, be a part of the community, you know, be an honest, hardworking citizen, but in a way that allows future generations to flourish. That's why he's growing kelp now just off the coast.
For you, what is your goal and hope for the series?
So many things. So for me, my goal and hope is that people take the future seriously. It's no longer just this thing that's out there, but they realize that the decisions they make are going to impact us, right? There's a term that we use in the show called the official future, which is, you know, it's going to be monorails or jetpacks, or it's going to be doom and gloom. That's important. It's important to have an idea of where you want to go. But if you become totally constrained by that, you lose a sense of agency, the ability to think about different tomorrows. So my goal and hope for the show is that people will have a renewed sense of agency, of hope, and of awe for what tomorrow could bring.
What gives Ari Wallach hope?
Oh, what gives Ari Wallach hope are two things. One, as a former kind of academic, it's history. I know where we've come from. And again, not everything is perfect today.
The futurist gets hope from history.
100%. 100%. I read history. I know how bad things can get. Not that long ago. Right now, things are pretty bad. But the fact of the matter is we are making progress. Again, I'd rather be alive now, anywhere on the planet, in any gender, in any race, than even, you know, 200 years ago. Look, 200 years ago, if you slipped and fell and you got a cut, you probably died. Now I run to the drugstore and I can put some cream on it and I don't die from that. So we've actually made progress in multiple areas. The other thing that gives me hope is my children, right? I get every day, I have three children and I see how they see the world. And look, I grew up with stories at night from my dad about what the Nazi regime did to his family and did to my family. I still share some of those stories with my children, but I also share stories with them about all the progress we are making as a society, as a species. Mm-hmm. And I see in them a desire to continue that, right? Look, in high school, I was on the track team, shockingly, and I ran the 100-yard dash. And I used to think, well, that's what life is all about. You know, the starting gun goes off, you run, you break through the tape, and then you're done and you die. And then I realized when I had children that that's actually not the case. What it really is, it's a very long marathon where I'm actually holding a baton that I took from my parents and that I will give to my children. And I already see as they're growing older, teenage daughters, a 10-year-old son, they're starting to reach back for that stick. And the way they're reaching back isn't through negativity bias. It's not through a fear of tomorrow, but it's with a hopeful lens of what they and their generation can do so that one day my great-great descendants, their children, their great-great descendants will look back on what we did, the decisions that we made to point us towards human flourishing as some of the most consequential decisions of our time. And that's what gives me hope because I can see that they're already starting to think like that.
How do you think? Like, what is one thing you can impart upon us, or what is one thing you think about in your life and that people should think about in terms of how to become a great ancestor?
Look, the answer might seem trite, but the answer is actually the question itself. When you are faced with a decision, it can be small, it can be big, whatever it is, you know, can you look in the mirror later that evening on how you made that decision and really say to yourself, was I being a great ancestor in doing that? And by the way, it's not always do we build this dam in this foreign country? We do this big, it could be that. If you're in a position to do that, that's one way of thinking about it. It's also like, how did you talk to your partner? How did you talk to your partner in front of your children at the dinner table that night? Because here's what I can tell you, and I write about this in the book. I found myself at one point in an argument with my wife about how she packed the groceries after we came back from Trader Joe's. And I realized that argument, that way of thinking, was an argument that my dad used to have with my mom. And it was probably an argument that he had about his mom going back to World War II. So I model that to my kids. But if I can break that or alter that way of being, I'm being hopefully not just a better parent, a better partner, but I'm modeling something for my children that they then will carry on to their children and their children and their children. So being a great ancestor doesn't have to be a big highfalutin thing. Not everyone is in the West Wing. Not everyone is around the boardroom table or in the Situation Room. Most of us are just living our daily life. And if we think about the long-term ramifications and implications of even those small actions, by the way, holding the door open for someone, those things actually reverberate. I know it sounds new age and woolly, but taken at scale, billions of us doing better things actually makes a better future.
Ari Wallach, congratulations on the new series.
Thank you.
We look forward to enjoying it. And
thank you.
Thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thank you for having me.